If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It's January 8th, 2025. It's 2:40 in the afternoon and hi and happy new year. This is John Williams. And you're listening to the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin, a communications specialist drawing on decades of experience as an award-winning journalist, communications consultant, government reform worker, and community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Ironlight, a marketing agency working to change the world.
I'm Kate Plies, former reporter and Chicago columnist, now doing the Chicago History website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, the rapidly aging publisher of the Picayune Sentinel.
Well, aren't we all? What's the matter, Eric? What's that all about?
Well, why would you say that?
I just turned 67 2 days ago. So.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
You're a January 6th guy, aren't you?
Yeah, right. And now I'm my late 60s. It's really an odd expression to use, but here I am.
And it's all good, Eric. 66 is the new 50.
I'll take it.
I saw Mike Madigan said that he's 82, but a young 82.
He looks pretty good, actually. The guy put on a nice show. We'll get to that in a minute. About January 6th, though, real quick, did you all watch much of the certification of the vote? I did. We would drop in and out of it during my radio show. We'd listen to it, and I was able to see some of it as well. And I was sort of happy to see what a simple procedure it was, what a simple procedure that it was that we were able to do without drama, without the storming of the Capitol, without any controversy. I know that's a really low bar. I'll finish this sentence, but I'll take it back. But I was like, okay, we're back. The Congress is actually being a Congress, and it's certifying the vote. And there's the vice president standing there next to Mike Johnson, of all people. And it was so civil, it was almost boring. And I was happy to see that.
It was a little weird to see Mike Johnson kind of smirking sometimes behind Kamala Harris, it seemed like to me, just a few times.
Maybe.
Well, I'll be honest, I never even knew that they certified the elections. It's just like this was something that took place kind of behind the scenes. I don't even know if there were news stories about it.
No. First time I've ever noticed it.
I just thought that you got elected and then you got sworn in. I had no idea there was that formal process.
Austin has DVDs of some of his favorite certification votes, and he goes back and watches them sometime with friends.
Yeah. I was thinking about Nassim Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan and Anti-Fragile. He's an interesting intellectual, and he had this line about, you can judge the civic health of a country based on how boring its local newspapers are, and Switzerland has the most boring ones. And that's what I thought about with the certification. It's good to be boring.
I would just suggest Congress isn't back. The Democrats are back, behaving as they always had. But did you see the husband of the Nebraska senator when she was sworn in by Harris? He refused to shake Harris's hand.
I saw that video too. How low class can you get?
That gentleman does use a cane. And there's some question about whether or not that was him giving offense or him actually not having a free hand.
I'm looking forward to the inauguration when Biden, I'm sure, will show up and be gracious about it. I mean, one of the great things about the United States was that the peaceful transfer of power for
years,
and then suddenly it wasn't, and now it's back. We hope.
Well, see there, USA. So, Mike Madigan took the stand 2 days ago. Or was it just yesterday? Today is Wednesday?
Yesterday. I took it on the afternoon, yeah.
And for over 3 hours, he did something few of us have ever seen. He spoke in what, by all accounts, was a positive performance. He looked at the jurors. He remained calm. He smiled. He laughed. He admitted to helping people get jobs, but not for personal gain, and talked about his life in a way that could make one almost root for the 82-year-old who was just playing the game. but carefully. He refuted some of the testimony against him and presented under the helpful questioning of his attorney, himself as a man who had gained much power but who had not abused it. The Tribune described his appearance on the stand as stunning and risky. Mike Madigan, our former long-serving House Speaker, is charged with 23 counts of bribery, racketeering, and wire fraud. And as we speak, he's undergoing cross-examination, like literally right now. It's now 2:45, or at least he was when I got off the air. His closing exchange with his defense attorney was, "Were you proud to be an Illinois Democrat? I was. What was your top priority? To work every day in the interest of working families. Have you ever traded your public office for private gain? No." And they rest.
Well, I have a brief show and tell for everybody. I don't know, John, I don't remember if I told you this. So right before, I've never been in the same room as Madigan, despite all the work that I've been doing around his political moves for a long time. And I went to Dirksen right before the holiday to meet with Lou Chuckman, who is the last remaining Cook County sketch artist who's been doing it for 40 years, because I bought several of his sketches.
You've got them. You told us you were going to do it, but look at that.
I got a bunch of them.
Those look good. And those are in color.
They're pretty good. And they're reasonably priced. So everybody should go support Lou Chuckman. I was totally shocked by him taking the stand. But definitely, as I told you earlier today, John, I think it's tough to read that as anything but an act of desperation. The fact that he was, if you're a politician who's been indicted by the feds and you're talking about, you know, your difficult upbringing and a father who did not show you love and was an alcoholic and smacked you in the face, I mean, trying to paint that kind of a picture, given the hours and hours and hours of testimony and recordings that this jury has heard, it just seems like a very desperate move, but something you would expect from Rod Blagojevich in his trial, but definitely not expect from Madigan in his.
Doesn't mean it won't work, though. I mean, I'd play the sympathy card if I had one, or the humanizing card. I mean, Kate, didn't you think like, oh, I never knew Mike Madigan in this light? The biography, brief as it was more than I'd had in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, Austin, you must be right that this is a move out of some desperation, given that they're looking back, especially, I'm sure, at Alderman Burke's trial. And yet, you know, you're talking about what is a fairly complicated case, over 60 witnesses, I think. The trial's gone over 3 months already. I have to admit that if I was a juror, I think he might get just a little bit of an edge over me, because like I loved just the Sun-Times, including the fact that when his defense attorney called him, he said, the defense calls Mike Madigan. And, you know, just calling him Mike Madigan, not, you know, Michael D. Madigan or whatever it is.
Speaker Madigan.
I call Mike Madigan. Yeah. And I think it was maybe the Tribune that made the point of saying that he spoke in, you know, that simple kind of Southside Chicago accent.
Yep.
Those things would really resonate with me, along with his personal history. I can see where they were putting the building blocks to make you understand that his entire life showed him that this is how Chicago and politics and the world work, that you get jobs through people you know, little by little. There's nothing strange or wrong about that. His father got him his first job, I think the first one.
On the dirt truck.
No, there was one before that, but then came the dirt truck, which turns out to be the old term for a garbage truck, things like that. So setting all that up as just, that's how things went. That was normal in a very routine way. That was really interesting. Now, I'd be interested, because Austin, I know you're following this so much more closely than I am, God knows. But the recordings that I have heard, none of them have been along the lines of what we heard from Alderman Burke's trial, right?
Right.
Alderman Burke just sounded so sleazy and horrible. The complete antithesis of the smooth Alderman Burke who would speak in city council. The only ones I've heard have been ones where I went, oh, he just sounds like this normal guy. He sounds like my dad. He sounds like so-and-so. He's got his favorite South Side restaurant where he likes to eat, and he tells his kids, I'll pay for dinner if you come here, because I don't want to go to the North Side. And as a South Sider especially, and I think anybody who doesn't live on the North Side, you go, yeah, I get that.
I totally agree, just briefly, that Mike McClain and Danny Solis come off as way more, you know, half-cocked and irresponsible and sleazy than Mike Madigan does in all of these recordings. So I would 100% agree with that.
What I don't get is, I did find it interesting. All of this is true. Way more information about him, more personal information than we ever knew, and more words than we've ever heard him speak at one time, sure. But how does that make one sympathetic exactly? So, you know, you had a rough childhood. Your dad never said he loved you. By the way, I taught my dad to say he loved me when he was in dementia phase. Like, a lot of us grew up with a lot of difficulty. Many, many Illinoisans grew up without a father at all. Does that mean they should steal taxpayer money for personal gain? What does this have to do with the charges on the table? We all overcame whatever we overcame, or we were fortunate enough not to have big hurdles and had an easy life and skated, whatever. But either way, is it an excuse for dishonesty or theft of public dollars?
Well, he's not saying he did any of that. He's not saying he did
any of
that.
Well, I know, but that's what he's charged with, and he didn't really respond to that.
I would play this card. I also think that, didn't he present himself as a hard-working guy? One of the reasons he said he was blindsided by the misdeeds of the others was because he worked hard, and he figured they'd be working hard, too. Who knew that there would be corruption here in the kingdom, you know? Marge, you don't have to buy... Well, you don't have to buy any of this. But Eric, how did you read the testimony so far?
Well, I haven't followed it, you know, closely enough, because I haven't been in the courtroom. I tell you, I think I said the same thing that Austin did on your radio show, which is, it struck me as a bit of desperation that this is it's a high risk move to put a defendant on the stand, which is why so few criminal defendants do take the stand. And it suggests to me, without any inside knowledge, that his lawyers think it's not going well enough for him. I know.
How could it be? How much did it help Ed Burke to sit on the sidelines?
Well, you know, I think Brad Blagojevich hurt himself when he testified on his behalf in his second trial. What happened in his first trial, he did not. And the jury hung, but there was only one holdout. And so I think his lawyers then realized, or he realized in the second go around, that he was going to try something else, because if he couldn't count on one nutty person holding out for him. So it strikes me that his attorneys, and he's got really good attorneys, and I think that they probably told him that things are not going that well for you, and that if we don't humanize you in front of the jury, we can't get them to like you. And if they like you, if just one of them really relates to you and says, yeah, my dad didn't tell me he loved me either, or, you know, I mean, it's sort of a Hail Mary pass. The idea that this is politics as usual, I just grew up, this is the old way of doing things. That's what Dan Rostenkowski said when he got caught, and that's what George Ryan tried to say when he got caught, and that's what Rob Blagojevich, that's what they all say. Every politician who goes in the dock always says, it's just politics. It's politics as usual.
And they have a smoking gun? Because they did on Blago. They sort of did on George Ryan. He had money in his pocket. What's going to send him to jail?
My guess is, and I will defer to Austin on this, because I think he's been following it more closely than I have. My guess is that it's just the accumulation of, you know, coincidences and deals that got done, and how else could you explain them other than the fact that he did this. So like I say, my sense is that this is a Hail Mary pass on the part of his attorneys, that they think that he's going to not succeed.
I think it's how close his official actions were to the private gain of his friends is ultimately, I think, what could take him down. And to the point on taking the stand, notably in the ComEd 4 case, and Permaggiore and John Hooker, two of the four, they did take the stand, and they were guilty on all counts. So, and you know, that's a really key component of this case as well. So I would agree. It's not like, you know, the chips are stacked against him at this point. And I weirdly actually haven't. So I've been following Jason Meisner. He's been doing an awesome job just tweeting from the courthouse every day.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the intricacies of what's being alleged here, I've said this a lot on the show, but it's just sort of those personal details about the nature of whether or not this individual is corrupt is not as important as the fact that we still have no rules for conflict of interest in the Illinois General Assembly. And this is happening now, and we know it's happening now. And it's a great opportunity for the leaders of the state, Governor Pritzker, Speaker Welch, President Harmon, to actually make significant ethics reforms. And we have not, that's just not in the conversation at all right now.
I hear you on that. And I know you've said that before, and you got to keep saying that, Austin, because someday somebody's going to hear it. But Austin, and I'll ask all of you, do you think that, and again, this is pending cross-examination, but do you think he's helped himself in the first round of questioning? And I think he has.
I don't think he's hurt himself. I mean, it depends, obviously, like what the cross-examination is. And I think he's, if you were to like in a lab construct a person who would be good at not answering questions in cross-examination, it would be someone like Michael J. Madigan. But I kind of agree. It's painting a picture of, listen, when you're in a position of power in the state, many people ask you for things all of the time. He's painting a picture that's saying, no, I did not always do things that ComEd wanted. In fact, I was most often against them and very skeptical of them.
Right.
You know, this McLean guy was kind of doing his own. I didn't have anything to do with this McLean guy and what he said. I didn't have anything to do with what Danny Solis said. And in fact, when Danny Solis said to me something that intimated that this was a quid pro quo, I took him aside and I said, no, that's not, don't use that kind of language. I don't see how any of that hurts him for sure.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't hurt. And of course he told him not to use that language because it's bad for him. If anyone says it out loud, we don't say the quiet.
Yeah, I don't know what's worse, quid pro quo or telling somebody not to say
right
quid pro quo.
Well, you know, and as a juror, I think look slightly more favorably on a defendant who chose to take the stand. I know you're not supposed to think that way, but you know, when I see a defendant, if I'm a juror sitting there and he or she won't get up and tell me their side of the story, it makes me wonder a little bit. And again, I know that's not the law and it's not fair. But it's a gut reaction I have. If I come home and I find that all the cookies are gone out of the cookie jar, and I ask one of my kids, "You take the cookies?" And they say, "I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to. I have a right not to tell you anything." You say, "Well, yeah, you. I guess you do. But that tells me that you stole the cookies."
Exactly. And Mike Madigan is not. He's not the defendant in the, well, this is not the movie where the defendant is behind the scenes going, "I want to testify for myself," and his lawyers are like trying to hold him down. "No, no, we can't let you on the stand." No, this is, he is the Sphinx, right? He can obviously completely control himself. He has told us himself now how he learned to do that his whole life because of his abusive father, who Marge doesn't care about. So hard-hearted, Marge.
Oh, I don't mean to be hard-hearted. I just think a lot of us
did a fabulous job.
Hurdles.
He did an amazing job at it, and his lawyers knew perfectly well that he could do that. You know that they've been rehearsing, and they've got that all completely under control because that's what Mike Madigan does. He has everything under control.
Yeah.
One other thing, yeah, I would say, because Austin, you or somebody mentioned about the great tweeting, I think you did, Austin, from the trial by the reporters. I just bow down to these reporters these days who can tweet during this whole event, be it a city council meeting or a trial that they're supposed to be covering, and that they have to file a story for within a couple of hours, not even at the next paper press deadline, but at their digital deadline in just a couple of hours. It's astounding to me that they can do that. But
good
they
copy,
do.
And it's good copy. Some of Jason Meisner's tweets were verbatim than in the published story, and it flowed lovely. It was perfectly well written. He was writing it in real time, and I noticed that, Kate. This is trivial maybe, but one of the things that does bug me about Mike Madigan that has come out, and it's not brand new, but it was the fact that he didn't have a cell phone and he didn't have even an email address or did not use email. He must have had an email address, but he didn't exchange via email. And his excuse was, I'm not sure why that came up at the trial, but it sure does look like it's just a good way to cover your tracks. You leave no tracks. But he said, well, when the cell phones came along, I was already speaker. And when email came along, I was already speaker. So I had staff in an office to handle that. But I think that's a bunch of bull. That, to me, is just a smart way to run a criminal enterprise.
Yeah, I'm sure I wouldn't be the first one to say he's Paulie from Goodfellas. But at the same time, I do know plenty of older businessmen who never learned how to type. And so they wouldn't do it on a computer either. And so they really wouldn't do email. And once you don't have to, sometimes you don't. So it's not completely out of the realm of possibility.
It almost sounds like a power play.
He's just old enough that he can get away with that. Yeah. Anybody else coming after him will not be able to get away with it in that same way. But at his age level, I would say, yeah, I can believe it.
And I would say it hurt him in some ways because we did buy michaelmadigan.com as a URL because he was so old school that he did not own that. So if you want to watch the documentary, you can go to that website. It's still there.
Nice play.
Give that a better plug.
Yeah.
You can go to michaelmadigan.com and watch the documentary we made on Michael Madigan in 2016, maybe. We're going to have to do a 10-year, like,
well, I think
cut thing or something.
You need a new edition because new information has come to light. This trial, how long has this been 10 years in the works? Did I see that correctly? Is my math good on that? The original tape recordings, maybe not the trial, but the case goes back 10 years.
Yeah, that's not that far off. Maybe it's not as at 10, but the Solis working with the federal government goes back quite a ways.
Well, that was the first domino. The Rascals continue after this message from our sponsor. If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, the fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique stores and small-town coffee shops and award-winning locally brewed beer. That stuff at the Lone Buffalo is pretty good, I can tell you. And all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. They've got hotels, private rentals, cottages, Airbnbs. Start making memories in Ottawa, the middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere. And the Illinois Office of Tourism. Let's go back to this latest episode, the first of the new year of the Mincing Rascals. President-elect Trump says that the United States needs more or complete control over Greenland and the Panama Canal and Canada. The nation of Canada would be a nice cherry on top, too. Oh, and the Gulf of America. He's going to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico. And actually, Marjorie Taylor Greene has authored a bill to do just that, as though it's ours to name. These can all be fun things to talk about. Eric Zorn said on my show the other day, hey, this is great fun for you on the radio. The circus is back. And I would dedicate a whole broadcast to these and similar topics. But I also think our audience would be equally served by not discussing them at all. A political science professor from the University of Illinois said to us today that Trump is better regarded for his actions than his words. And that made me think that for all the talk, the big, beautiful wall never got built. So maybe we don't need to fret over, even spend any time on the absurdity of these proposals. Marge, what's your reaction to that? Should we even pay any attention to some of this nonsense?
He loves to distract. And when he does crazy stuff like this, you probably saw he posted a map going from Canada to Panama and covered it with the version of the American flag. You know, he likes to antagonize and distract. So what's he distracting us from? Is he distracting us from the news that he will not be lowering the price of groceries anytime soon? Is he distracting us from the news that he's not really going to pardon all of the January 6th folks, and that he's not sure how to choose who to pardon and who not to pardon. They're just going to look at it. Is he distracting us from the increasing role of Elon Musk as he tries to influence governments in Europe, you know, the UK and Germany? Is he distracting us from his hand deeper and deeper into the till? But to spend the time fretting or laughing, we fell into the laughing trap before. We just thought he was hilarious. None of this could happen. And some of it did happen. So I just think we need to be on guard.
Do you think that the distraction is calculated, or is that just a function of him speaking off the top of his head? He talks out of his head and it becomes distracting. But you make it sound like he's saying, look over here on purpose with this craziness while I do something that's a little more devious.
I think somewhat, but also he pulls it from somewhere. It's not just crazy in his head. BBC today interviewed a member of the parliament of Greenland who said, we do need help. We do need more security in the oceans. We need to protect against vessels from China and Russia. And if our allies are going to step up, we would welcome that. There's something out there that he's drawing on, and then we'll just buy it is his, you know, nonsense. But I just, you can't dismiss anything. And I wouldn't spend a lot of time laughing at it, but I also don't want to lose focus on some of the really serious things that are and can happen if his nominees all go through, for example.
You know, I've never actually really thought about whether it would be an advantage to the United States to own Greenland the way we own Puerto Rico, I guess. Would there be any kind of strategic advantage to that? We have a military base there. It's not, and of course, it's mineral rich. But are we going to, is it worth it to us to, I mean, let's just say that Denmark went along with it, which they show no inclination to do.
100 billion.
Would it be worth it? Would it be worth the money to spend that? Or is this just, you know, guy with a couple of drinks in him at the end of the bar saying, you know what we ought to do? We ought to buy Greenland.
It would be worth it because I think the government has a list of like the 50 most important minerals for military and industry, and they have like 43 of them. It's an incredibly important deposit of minerals over there, which are not currently being exploited yet. It's all still under exploration, and the key will be to see who can actually get it all up out of there. But like Denmark is saying, it doesn't want to sell off Greenland, but Greenland actually does want its own independence.
Right.
And Greenlanders have their own ideas.
My initial reaction to this, because it's a Trump idea, is it's a really stupid idea and he's an idiot. But I don't necessarily think that every single idea that he ever has is idiotic. I mean, I got to be fair about it and think like, well, maybe this is a good idea. Maybe, you know, the blind hog has found an acorn. That you have to take these things on their merits, and maybe this is meritorious. I mean, maybe he's saying that China is running the Panama Canal, which I don't follow Panama Canal news very carefully. And maybe there's a case to be made for renegotiating the deal with Panama. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to fall into the trap. I should say this. I just say this blankly or across the board. I don't want to fall into the trap of automatically dismissing everything that Trump says as a terrible idea, because it might not be. Now, the odds are good that it is, but it's not 100% for me. So
Not running the Panama Canal.
Okay, well, I don't get the Panama Times. I really don't follow the Panama Canal.
Oh, I
get
think the New he York did Times. That. I think he said brought up Panama because Carter was getting so many accolades upon his death that he wanted to throw dirt on the grave, not in the way the Jews do it to honor people. But I also wonder, with all those minerals, you guys talking about that makes me think, are those the minerals that Elon Musk needs for his businesses?
Sure.
I mean, Elon Musk is the thing to focus on.
We bought Alaska. Of course, we had a willing suitor in that case. I'm kind of like Eric. At first, I thought, this is the craziest thing I ever heard. And then I realized that other administrations have sort of stuck their nose in that just to see what the possibilities and viability is of it. And if Greenland came to us and said, hey, show us a number, would we say no to it? Now, Russia didn't realize how much of a store they were selling us when they gave us Alaska. Who knows what's under the ice in Greenland? Austin, mm-hmm. if you had $100 billion laying around, would you make the deal?
Yes. I'm
a year?
For one, I'm like just ideologically, I would like there to be a billion Americans. So any more land we can possess, that would be good. So I think there's only like 50,000 people who live in Greenland.
Yeah,
so
that's I was gonna say,
however, it could become a place where more people want to go. Iceland has been growing. So I think it's important to disaggregate the three. So I think the remarks on Greenland are different than Canada, which are different than Panama. So for Greenland, Greenland will remain quasi-independent, I think, and we're negotiating really some kind of long-term binding partnership in the Arctic, which is important to have. And this perhaps will become more formal. That's what I would expect for Greenland. For Panama, I think that is just purely a threat to China. I think that is like the rhetorical point of that, like to what Eric was saying. And then Canada, I've been thinking about, and I couldn't come up with anything other than it's a joke and perhaps a gift to Pierre Poilievre, you know, because this was made, I think he made those remarks prior to Trudeau announcing he was going to resign. So I think that might be sort of a political favor in some ways.
Facebook is not going to fact check anymore. And the Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post cartoonist Anne Telnes has resigned after its editorial page editor rejected for the first time one of her cartoons. The cartoon that got axed, seen online now by more people than would have seen it if they had just run the dang thing, showed various media icons bowing with bags of money at the feet of a giant Donald Trump statue. And among those paying tribute, besides Mickey Mouse and others, was the Washington Post CEO Jeff Bezos. And if that looks bad for WAPO or Bezos, then that gets canceled for the first time. They didn't fire her, but they said they weren't going to run it. She quit. They said, well, let's talk a little bit about it over the weekend. She didn't want to do that. They said, by the way, as I recall, their explanation wasn't that it was because they disagreed with making fun of the owner of the paper, but rather because they'd already run a sarcastic piece about it. Donald Trump and the media people that are paying homage to him, and it was redundant. I think that was the word they used. It was repetitive from the comments that they'd already published. I've seen the Tribune publish the same thought more than once. Erica, you noticed this whole couple of stories. You even brought up the Robert Feeder story when we talked about it.
Well, and just to catch up, the Robert Feeder story was that Facebook last week, on I guess on New Year's Day, decided that they were going to pull Robert Feeder's personal Facebook page, and they didn't really give him any reason for it. And he couldn't get any human being on the line to explain to him what was going on because, you know, he's had a Facebook page for a long time and he's a well-known person. Why would they take it away from him? And he's not a particularly political person in terms of what he puts online. And, Kate and I are friends with Robert and with Neil Steinberg, who wrote the column. And Neil Steinberg sort of came to the rescue and wrote a column about it, but even Neil couldn't get a response from Facebook for a couple of days. And finally, after we spoke, I discovered yesterday, John, that Facebook had reinstated Feeder, but without explanation. So the idea there being that Facebook is this monolith, this unresponsive monolith, that unless you're a newspaper columnist for a large newspaper in a large city, they're going to ignore you. And they ignored. I reached out also when I saw what had happened to Robert's page. But about the cartoon, the idea of it being redundant, I have to say that I talked to Chris Jones, the editor of the Tribune, and he said that he was appalled by what they had done to telling us at the Post, the pulling that straight. He would have run a similar cartoon as in his role as the editorial page editor of the Tribune, and I was really glad to see that. And it's true that a lot of cartoons are redundant, or I use the word complementary to written commentary, that they usually have a much sharper edge and they can draw people into a topic in a way that just a bunch of words on a paper don't. And that's why political cartoons are still around in this digital age. So I think it was a huge mistake on the part of the Post to do that, because it just called so much attention to them. And in a troubled time, they just laid off a bunch of employees, I think today or yesterday. And of course, they lost, I think, 200,000, 250,000 subscribers last last fall, when Bezos decreed that they weren't going to endorse a presidential candidate. And a lot of people thought that that was him sucking up to Trump, because they were clearly going to endorse Kamala Harris. And so that was a big blow to the paper. And again, if the Post had endorsed Harris, it would have been a half a day story at the most. Everyone expected the Washington Post to endorse Kamala Harris. Big deal, right? But they didn't endorse anybody, and this was a national scandal. And again, the same thing with this cartoon, which is, you know, who would have seen that cartoon? How many, you know, maybe a couple hundred thousand people would have seen it and gone, oh, okay, yeah, it was a decent cartoon. And now, I mean, literally millions of people have seen it. It's been, I put it on my Facebook page and asked people to share it, and I think it was like 90 shares, and it's just my little Facebook page. So people are really spreading that around. I don't quite understand the thinking behind trying to, I know censor is the wrong word, but to edit something like that out, just seems like a really rookie mistake, especially when it was done by the editor of the Washington Post opinion page, who saw exactly what the blowback is when you try to suppress a point of view.
Only thing I would add to that is that in David Shipley's defense, the op-ed editor, they did run at least two pieces on the issue, banging on Bezos and the others. I've never actually seen it said that the cartoon had been accepted and then pulled. They simply didn't decide to run it. And those are two different things. And they're going to be mad sometimes when their favorite cartoons don't run. I mean, that does happen. So I will give them that. It's not like they ignored the entire issue, and they do have a right to not decide to pick whatever cartoons the cartoonist likes best to run. And the main thing to me is, it's not a good cartoon. I would go so far as to say it's a lousy cartoon.
Why?
Because it is the very first idea that anybody would come up with for how to visualize people sucking up to Trump.
Bags of money at his feet.
A statue of Trump. Yeah. Three people that we recognize bowing to it. It's the most sophomoric, obvious idea ever. Is it even possible that perhaps David Shipley was simply being polite by not saying, wow, I didn't run this because it sucks?
Wow, this is a hot take. This is good.
I'm sorry. It's a lousy cartoon. It's not like I disagree with the sentiment, but it's a lousy cartoon.
By that standard, a lot of political cartoons are fairly obvious.
Oh, definitely. I don't like a lot of...
Standards like that, we would never see any political cartoons.
No, don't listen to my radio show, because I'm telling you, sometimes you state the obvious.
What part of cartoon don't you understand? They're broad. I want to go back to Eric was hesitating to use the word censorship. And I think that's at the core of this whole topic, because Zuckerberg is claiming that fact-checking is censorship. We're hesitating to say pulling a cartoon is censorship. The whole definition of free speech and censorship is critical to truth, to our democracy. And yet we've blurred the lines. We don't know when to use those words. We don't agree on what they mean anymore. How did that happen exactly? How did we get to this place where facts are censorship?
Well, I just want to say censorship to me is a government act that really only a government can censor something. Because censorship means that there's an official act that prevents a thought or a drawing from being distributed. The Washington Post can't censor somebody. The Washington Post can refuse to publish something. They refuse to publish things all the time, I'm sure, letters and so on. And Ann Telnus was certainly free to spread that drawing around the globe. And that's why I hesitated to use censorship. I wasn't trying to say that it wasn't a crappy idea or that I agreed with it. I was just saying that I want to be careful when I use that word censorship, because I've gotten it myself. And when I don't publish a comment or a letter, someone says, hey, you're censoring me. Like, no, that's not censorship. That's editing. It may not be good editing on my part or on the part of the Post, and Kate and I can disagree on that, but it is just editing. It's not like they're saying, we're going to take this cartoon and rip it up, we're going to go to your house and lock you up, and you're not going to be able to let anyone see that. So that was my...
Zuckerberg is using the word in this context.
What do you mean?
Censorious or whatever.
In terms of Facebook and whether he means fact checkers.
Yeah, so he's saying that because we were putting fact checkers in place there and we were correcting false information, we were censoring free speech. That's Trump's whole point of view, that you should be able to say anything, whether it's true or not. And now Zuckerberg is going along with it. And so is maybe Bezos.
Okay, but what's a better ecosphere then? Should we have people should be able to say whatever they want and the public will sort the truth? Maybe the public comments page will sift through that and eventually a person will find the truth? Or do you want to ask the company itself to be the gatekeeper?
Remember when Kellyanne Conway said, defending Trump, you know, there's facts and alternative facts? That was the beginning of this, right? There are no alternative facts. And this is firing on a lot of cylinders. So meanwhile, our education system is going down the tubes, and so people don't have the training to make decisions. Media is falling apart, so they don't have a lot of reliable resources or don't choose to access them to know facts. I don't know if I have a straight answer to your question, but I do think that fact-checking, when you have something as pervasive and influential as one of these platforms, I feel they have a responsibility to offer at least the actual facts and then let people decide.
Yeah, I think the language, it is important to be precise in the language. So I think Zuckerberg is saying censorship, and I'd have to look back at actually his speech to see exactly in what part he used it. But I'm okay with him using terms like censorship, given that the federal government was actively pressuring him and other social media companies to take down certain kinds of speech on their platforms, while also bringing him in front of Congress and having hearings about antitrust and sort of saying like, well, you kind of better play ball on this. So I have no problem with him using terms like censorship. But John, what you said at the beginning was Zuckerberg getting rid of fact checking. But to be more precise, he's changing the content moderation regime at Facebook. And in my opinion, it's for the best. He's changing the regime to be less dependent on sort of the council of elders, the groups that they've paid to kind of go over certain news stories. And then if it's flagged in a certain way, its traffic goes down by like 80% or more. So that was old censorship or old content moderation regime. New content moderation regime, he said, would be more like community notes, which predates Elon Musk's owning of X. And as someone who's used Twitter and now X for a long time, I think is like incredibly good and is a technological solution to content moderation that gives us the best of all worlds in terms of maximizing the amount of speech and maximizing the correction. Just so people know how that works, it doesn't, I don't think if something is community noted, its reach diminishes, but if something gets a community note, it means that some user wrote some clarification and then two people or more of basically who rate those claims in opposite ways as helpful or not happen to agree on that note, then it gets noted. And it's a great way, I think, to scale at scale, have some kind of content moderation around things that are half-truths or complete lies that actually works when you're talking about billions of people typing stuff every day.
Can you give us an example, Austin? Can you give me an example of late or in the past of how that plays out?
Yeah, some good ones are like, honestly, where I found it to be most helpful is in images of the war in Gaza. So if there's video footage, for example, oftentimes there's video footage on either side that's extremely graphic or, you know, very emotional. And there will be a community note that says this footage is actually from, July of 2017, and it was in Jordan or something like that. And that means that a bunch of people have written notes. They've been rated by all sorts of different people on whether they're helpful or accurate on a bunch of different measures. And then one has gotten sufficient support to be pinned below the post. So I think that's a really good method.
Doesn't happen in real time, though, then, does it? So do I need to go back, or will that content reappear in my queue somehow? How do I know that after the fact that's been fixed or noted?
Yeah, it's not. You're never going to get stuff that's like exactly in real time, I don't think. That'd be pretty tough to do at scale. So yeah, if you see something that doesn't have a community note and it's fake, you saw something fake. But I don't think the old content moderation regime, you know, would have fixed that either.
But in your example, why wouldn't they just, once Facebook has established, or Twitter or X has established, that it's a video from a certain time, why wouldn't they just say, well, that, let's just take that down?
Yeah.
It's just wrong.
I think it's actually better to keep it up, because the way that misinformation could, it would spread is if you, people see this and then they're going to see it on other platforms, and having it spread with the actual disclaimer and source that it's fake, I think actually can better combat any kind of misinformation at scale than just taking something down.
Yeah, that's a good point, Austin. I really like that.
And I suppose someone could also make the argument like, is what this video was so raw, so powerful.
Exactly. It feeds the beast. It feeds conspiratorial thinking when it gets taken down, right. Definitely.
I don't actually remember if Zuckerberg used the word censorship, but it definitely, what was going on there often did amount to censorship, because if you recall from all the emails that came out during, say, the Twitter files, we actually saw the emails from the Twitter executives talking about the fact that they would have to have often daily meetings with various federal officials, especially from the FBI, where they would have to be on a Zoom call with them. And the federal officials would be like, we want to see this taken down. We want to see this taken down. And they were often, the federal officials, very angry. The Twitter executives are like, we had to tell them, you know, this is actually true. You're asking us to take down things that are true. And, you know, the government didn't care. So that is government, and by Eric's definition there, which I agree with, that does come to censorship, which sometimes they weren't taking it down, but they were doing what they would call shadow banning it, where they would tag it with some particular tag so that the algorithm would simply not let the post or person, would not let their material be seen by other people. You know, I wouldn't mind it if Zuckerberg kept the information from his fact-checking organizations if he simply incorporated them as part of the community notes that he's planning to do, like X, as opposed to using them to shadow ban people. Let's face it, in the last especially 4 years or so, I've lost count of the number of things that their fact checkers suppressed and called conspiracy theories that we now know are true.
Like what?
The lab leak theory. Where did COVID-19 come from? Now the consensus is that it probably did leak from the Wuhan virology lab. But as you'll recall, when it first came out, it was labeled by especially Francis Collins and Dr. Fauci, but also the entire government, as being a wild and racist conspiracy theory. And it was suppressed. But it turns out it's probably true.
Well, it was expressed in racist terms.
It was debated and explored.
Does this make any sense, though? Like, I appreciate what you just said, Kate, and I'm glad Austin took the time to explain that other content moderation. But it does seem to me like if it's about healthcare or the election results or something that's really important, and somebody's putting out something that is patently, unequivocally not true, like, I don't know, Joe Biden won the election. You can't say anything but that Joe Biden won that election against Donald Trump the first time. I would have no trouble hitting a cancel button. Maybe that would be cutting off my nose, Austin. Maybe I'd create more trouble for myself if I did. But it seems to me like you're just sitting there watching this stuff wash out into the sea, and it's garbage.
Here's how you prevent yourself from using the button. If the button is some official from the federal government or a related agency goes and talks to the platform to say, hey, this is this is a lie.
What if it is a lie?
Why shouldn't you do that? Here's exactly why you shouldn't do that. And this is what I was thinking when there was a lot of uproar yesterday about what Zuckerberg said. And it speaks to this cartoon. As soon as we accept the idea that officials from the federal government should be able to go to a business and say, hey, you need to do XYZ with the content on your platform, that's not breaking a law, it's just a lie, then you create these entities like a Meta or an X or a whoever that need to suck up at all times to the federal government, regardless of who occupies it. So now Donald Trump has control and Republicans have control. And people are complaining about Mark Zuckerberg putting Dana White on the board of Meta. And, you know, we're going to move the content moderation team from California to Texas and doing all these virtue signally things. That is the inevitable consequence of getting the federal government involved in content moderation on these platforms. And it's one of the reasons you shouldn't do it.
Agreed. I mean, this is a basic tenet of free speech in general, any civil liberty. You have to be willing to let other people have the same freedom. And the minute you let the government decide what is truth and control what people say and control what we believe is the truth, free speech is over with. You know, during the Biden administration, we just have voluminous proof that it was the Biden administration pressuring Mark Zuckerberg and the other social media platforms to suppress and do content moderation. I didn't hear people complaining about that yesterday. They're only mad now that apparently Zuckerberg is not going to continue letting the federal government have these meetings where they browbeat Facebook and Twitter into doing what they want for content moderation. But if they did continue to do that, I think most liberals would not be happy because now it's the Trump administration.
Okay, so for public
issues. Okay, when Biden was doing it, but not now that Trump would be doing it, it doesn't make sense.
So for issues of public health or election integrity, the government should just sit on its hands. They shouldn't play any role on these public platforms. Is that what I'm hearing?
Not.
Wow. I mean,
well, they should put out accurate information. But as soon as it gets into the game of suppressing what other people say, and I think it is very important to think about the shoe on the other foot, because guess what? Shoes on the other foot. If we were talking about something like, hey, there's people putting up misinformation about the war in Gaza that perhaps is, you know, more sympathetic to the Palestinians, and the Trump administration goes into Facebook and says, hey, listen, we're supportive of Israel. Like, get this stuff out of here. This is a lie, and it's actually dangerous. I think that would be totally wrong.
Exactly.
And I think many people on the left would think that's totally wrong, too, and which is why I think it's a line you shouldn't cross.
Okay, well, I'm not sure that Trump is not browbeating the tech folks. This virtue signaling is kind of where I get stuck. Why move people from California to Texas? What are they saying there? I think that is offensive and just another way to bow down to Trump. I think Trump is exerting authority over Meta, and Elon Musk is exerting authority over them. It's just being done in a different way.
Well, you might be right about that, Marge. I mean, you are right. I mean, obviously, Mark Zuckerberg, all the other tech people, they're interested in what's best for their business. And I don't really understand why any of us would pretend otherwise or expect anything else. Of course,
that's right.
That's what they're all about. So he's not Mark Zuckerberg doing this because he cares about the First Amendment. Of course not. He is doing it to suck up to Trump. But is that not better in retrospect than to continue the same system that was going on under Biden, in which rather than have community notes, as there are going to be, you instead would have Trump's people meeting privately with Facebook and Twitter and telling them what to suppress? I would take community notes over the old system.
Are those our only choices? Is there not a way for these platforms to behave in the way that traditional media has, with some responsibility to the truth? I feel like there are, he's not voluntarily doing it. He doesn't think it's good for his business, but
well,
it
again,
is good for the country to focus on.
You want someone to decide what the truth is instead of letting people who are reading other people's words decide what they think. You want Meta, for instance, to decide what is true.
Some things are black and white and some things are not.
That's my point, Marge. Yeah, I don't think that it's always such a difficult thing to discern what the truth is. And if you want to lie that 2 + 2 = 5, that's okay. But I think there are some things that are more important than that. Austin, I don't have the perfect solution. You've been very interesting on this topic. I appreciate your input, but I still want my cancel button. Okay.
But you do have your cancel button, John. That's the point. We all have our own cancel button. But other people don't have a cancel button on us. One of the most major parts of free speech is not just saying what you want, but having the freedom to hear what other people say.
Yeah, I know, but I wish I had more faith in the American public to discern the truth from the ridiculous, because there's plenty of people that still think.
And you want to do that for them, John?
After this election, I have no faith.
On some stuff, absolutely. I think.
Okay, King John.
Really? You think that sounds arrogant? For instance, who won the 2020 election? Yeah, feel free to ask me. I can tell you that for sure with confidence.
But there would be a community note on that.
Okay. Our recommendations for. We won't do it all the time, but I asked you guys to come up with one thing that you would recommend that you are eating, drinking, listening to, reading, or watching. I'll go first. I think last time we spoke about this, I suggested Out of Nowhere is a really good movie. Really, really enjoyed that. The movie I saw the other night is the Spanish language French opera about a Mexican cartel leader who wants to undergo a sex change operation. Think about what that is. It is such a good movie. I really, really enjoyed Emilia Perez. And I only watched it because somehow I didn't have to pay for it. It was on my TV. And I thought, I heard about this at the Golden Globes. I think that's fantastic. It's a Spanish language. You can't get it in English. There's no button on your TV. French opera about a Mexican cartel leader who wants to undergo a sex change operation. I've since read that it's flawed in many ways. Fine. I enjoyed watching it.
I just read a book called Beautiful Ruins by Jessica Walter. It begins set in Italy on the filming set of Cleopatra, the movie starring that created the reunion of Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Eddie Fisher stormed the set to demand back his wife from Burton, who then was okay with it because he wanted Elizabeth Taylor. All that intrigue. But it follows a bit player who was cast in the movie. It's fiction, totally fiction.
Yeah.
Activities that happen that impact the lives of people, both Richard Burton, strangely, and also the proprietor of a small hotel, a pension in Italy, where this actress, a bit player actress, ends up spending some time. And it's a beautiful story. It takes it into present day Hollywood. And it's so well written. Jessica Walter, someone recommended it to me. I would never have found it otherwise. It's a beautiful, fast page turner. And a delight to see a fictionalized version that also throws a little dirt on Richard Burton.
Called Beautiful
Ruins. What a great premise. What was the title of that?
Beautiful Ruins.
Wow. Okay.
I may be the last person in America to have read James, the novel by Percival Everett that tells the Huckleberry Finn story through the eyes of the slave or the enslaved person, Jim. And he tells his story. I don't know, some of the adventures that he has or the travels he has with Huck Finn. Really powerful book, not terribly long. I think every book club in America is required by law to read it.
Mind it.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Did anybody else on the panel read it?
Brenda
yeah.
listened to it, and therefore I heard a lot of it. I don't think we liked it as much as America did.
It reminded me that there had been a book not too long ago that was a retelling of Pride and Prejudice from the point of view of the servants in the Bennett household. this basic turning of that coin is always very fruitful. I watched, on your recommendation, John, Say Nothing, the Hulu series. I don't know if it's produced by Hulu, but about two sisters in the Irish Republican Army. I think I have one episode left. We are just like chomping at the bit to watch it tonight. It is fabulous. Thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah.
I don't normally, even though I'm half Irish, I don't sympathize with IRA people. I don't sympathize in general or have any respect for people who bomb and use violence when they could be protesting peacefully and working politically. But this is so well done in terms of showing you the time period and the place, the bombed out places that they live, and just what it's like to be a Catholic at that time in Belfast, that like other great series like Breaking Bad, you do find yourself rooting for the terrorists somehow in many places. It's so well done. Definitely. Thank you. Thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah, the book is really good too. Patrick Radden Keefe's book with the same title.
Well, I saw A Complete Unknown, the Dylan biopic, before Christmas, and I was not pleased. So no. I watched again, because I hadn't seen it in many years, Don't Look Back, which is the documentary about film that came out in 1967 about his 1965 tour to England, which is not that far off from the period of his life that's depicted in A Complete Unknown. And I forgot that's one of the most perfect documentaries ever made, I think. It's so incredible.
Scorsese made that, right?
No, this is actually D.A. Pennebaker, who is from Evanston. He was born in Evanston, actually.
Wow.
And he also directed The War Room, which is the movie about Jimmy Carville and George Stephanopoulos on the Clinton campaign. And this was his first big feature, was Don't Look Back. And it was just kind of on a crazy coincidence that he ended up being with Bob Dylan at that time. And it's so good, and can't recommend it highly enough. It's awesome.
Why didn't you know, Griffin made me do the same thing. After we watched Out of Nowhere, then he sat me down and we watched that documentary for the 10th time for Griffin, first time for me. But why didn't you like the new movie?
I thought many, many issues. One, the worst thing you can say about it is it's 2 hours of Bob Dylan songs performed very well. So at a baseline, I think Timothy Chalamet did an amazing job. I thought the woman who played Joan Baez did an amazing job singing. Her name escapes me.
How about that? But, yeah, really good.
Yeah. I thought the writing was cheesy. I thought the casting of Johnny Cash was unforgivable, especially from the guy who made Walk the Line, which is great. I thought the writing of Pete Seeger's character was so one-dimensional and kind of like Mr. Rogers-y and goofy. And maybe I was just expecting too much from a biopic, because they're kind of all like that. But Chalamet gets props from me for sure for what he was able to do, but otherwise I thought it was kind of
Michael mediocre. Phillips had some of the same criticism. I talked to him about the movie after it came out, and he said some of the things you said, and then he goes, but for that kind of a movie, this is a really good one. Sometimes you're going to get two-dimensional characters and they're going to compact things. I thought the Johnny Cash character was a gas. I thought the Pete Seeger performance was terrific. Edward Norton,
I mean, there's so much interesting thing, so many interesting things you could say about the world and life through the story of Bob Dylan. And this was just kind of like, hey, I remember when there were hippies and this guy's kind of, you know, disturbing to people. Like, it didn't have a point of view really about anything. And there's so many cool things you can say when you're talking about this guy's life.
That's Austin Berg. Kate Plies is here too. Marge Halperin and Eric Zorn.
Okay. I'm going to put links to these on in the Picayune Sentinel tomorrow. And I also, Austin, would like to include, maybe if you could send me a photo of one of those drawings that you got from the court.
Yeah.
Hold that up again, Austin. I'll do play-by-play of it. How many did you end up buying, by the way?
An undisclosed number.
The courtroom drawings from the Madigan trial. Okay, hold another one up, because the first one you showed us looked terrific.
Look at that stack. Are there any left for us?
Oh, that's really neat. Are you going to try and cash in on this? There's Mike Madigan sitting behind, it looks like, his counsel. The gallery's behind him. So are you going to sell those on the internet and make money off of these?
No, that would be truly absurd. I'm going to give them as... I'm going to give them as gifts probably, and I might keep one.
Wow. Well done, sir. Okay, we're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. Hey, we're back. The Rascals are here. Share it with your friends. It's good to see your faces and hear your voices, guys. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, John.
Nice. Talk to you soon. Fun to be back.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.